This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Nicole Atchison earned a PhD in biomedical engineering and worked her way up to leadership roles in the medical device industry. But soybeans and peas and the chance to have a hand in building a healthier world led her back to her family's business. Nicole is now CEO of Purus Holdings, which partners with farmers to grow its seeds, then buys back the crops and transforms them into sustainable ingredients and plant-based foods. She also spun out and heads AcreMade, a direct-to-consumer plant-based egg company. Nicole's companies, combined with Purus Protein, which her brother runs, have 300 employees and have raised more than $100 million through a joint venture with Cargill and investments from other investors. Nicole, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
Your parents founded Purus in their basement in Iowa in the mid-1980s. You were employee number three. Tell us how you and your brother were involved as you grew up.
Yeah, I always joke that I was employee number three, but I was also about 3 years old. So I truly grew up in the business. And when we were young, it was, you know, being helpful or maybe trying to just stay out of the way and be unhelpful. But as we got a little older and the business started gaining traction, we were really focused on genetics at that point. In the mid-80s, my dad had this idea that in the future, people would eat more plants and that plants should taste good. And so he started his, you know, what has become a four-decade journey on creating seeds specifically designed for food. And our job, you know, through the first decade or two was to help do that mostly in the field. So we spent our afternoons, our weekends, our summers in the field. And most people think, okay, then you guys are farmers. Yes and no, not exactly. Our fields were much smaller than your typical, you know, farm field, maybe 10 acres, but they would have thousands of varieties. And our job would be to, you know, keep the field clean of weeds. So hoeing and, you know, picking weeds and then doing some of the breeding activities. So taking two varieties and putting them together to make a new variety. And as we got older, our responsibilities grew and grew. So we started off, I would say, as, you know, trying to stay out of the way, and then being a little bit helpful, and then doing a lot of the grunt work. And as once we were in high school, it was, you know, leading our summer team that really managed the fields. And so it was always all hands on deck for the first, I mean, it still is, but it was always all hands on deck and really doing whatever it took. But it was always outside. And so one of my favorite, or not favorite stories, but funny stories is I was very heat sensitive as a kid. And we were in one days in Southern Iowa, it was just really, really hot. And I was complaining about being hot. And that wasn't something that our family, that we did. We didn't complain. And I was getting a lot of grief about it. And, you know, a lot of the talks like, we got to do this. We got to get this done. Well, it turned out I had actually had heat stroke. And so my dad to this day still feels so guilty about that because there we were out in the field and he's giving me grief for complaining. And really, I was actually sick. But that's kind of how it was. I mean, it was hard work. It was dirty. It was, you know, it was gritty, but it was the foundation that, you know, led to the business that we run today and gave us really the work ethic, I think, that we carry forward now. And when we're not in the field, you always have that in the back of your head, like how hard that job is.
Well, at the time, most people didn't think of soybeans as a product for eating, but you guys were thinking of it that way. You were thinking of it for miso and tofu and things. It was rather unique at the time, right?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people didn't understand what we were doing because it seemed similar to what was standard in the agriculture industry, but slightly different. And the market that we were serving primarily at the time was an Asian market. And so we're in the middle of Iowa talking about products that they eat in Japan and Korea, which in and of itself was different. But it was really this concept of how can we make plants have more protein, but taste great so that when the time comes and people are going to eat more plants, that we have that foundational agriculture that works in the field as well as on the plate. And that starts at the genetics level. And that's really what we were doing.
So you were doing soybeans and corn. In the early 2000s, you guys turned to peas. Why?
We actually started breeding peas in 1999, and the thought at the time was one of our big areas is organic farming. And so a lot of our crops are used in organic farming systems, which don't use as many chemicals for weed control. And weed control is a huge issue in agriculture, and even more so in organic agriculture. And yellow field peas are grown in a way where they really cover the soil. And so they can suppress weeds, but they weren't adapted for Southern Iowa or the places where our farmers were. And so my dad's thought was, if we could get yellow field peas to work in the South, they could be used as a rotational crop in organic farming for weed control. They have the added benefit of they fix a lot of nitrogen in the soil, meaning that they take nitrogen from the air, put it in the soil, and that decreases the amount of chemical nitrogen or animal fertilizer that the farmer would need to actually apply to the field. So it's a win-win. And so he started developing, really adapting yellow field peas to these Southern production acres in the 1990s. And at the time, they looked terrible. They always looked like they were dead or dying. And it was a small plot. And everyone around him was asking him, why are we doing this? They always are dead. And he said, no, this is the future. This is what farming needs, more diversification, more rotation. And we kind of just let him do it, not knowing that was going to become the foundation of our company less than probably about 10 to 15 years later.
Your company is now the biggest pea protein maker, producer in North America. What do people do with all that pea protein?
So pea protein is used in a whole variety of foods. And I always share with my neighbors, you know, a lot of brands that people are familiar with at the grocery store, you turn around and look at the label, it says pea protein, there's a good chance that it comes from purists. And anything from plant-based milks to plant-based meats, so think your burgers or your brats or your dairy alternatives, yogurts, or protein shakes. Also in sports nutrition, so that protein shake in the morning that you mix with water, if it's pea protein, it might come from purists. And so we started the journey of pea protein in 2014. And fast forward to today, we were the first manufacturer in the United States. And today we're the largest manufacturer in North America. And it all started back at the seed in 1999. And so we were able to take that foundational breeding program and really accelerate it once we moved into ingredient processing, which really, if you think about, you know, being a visionary, I always give my dad a ton of credit of where everyone, including, you know, his kids were saying, why are we doing this? He said, nope, we're going to keep going. This is the future. And he was right.
You say it like it's so easy in a way, you know, that acceleration of the pea protein, but it involved building some plants, right?
That's right. Yep.
So, and how did you do that? How did you start?
So our model for Purus has been a lot about revitalizing distressed assets from other industries. And so we acquired a facility in Wisconsin that was a distressed asset. It was not being utilized and it had the ability to make proteins. And so we acquired that facility in the mid 2010s and started retrofitting it to be able to manufacture pea protein, which is different than what it was currently doing, but it had some of the equipment that was required. So we made the minimum required changes and started to find our way in this new pea protein industry. And at that time, pea protein was not a household name. Most people had never heard of it. And a lot of people kind of think, hey, that sounds gross. And so we had to do a lot of just storming the market and say, hey, this is what it is. This is how it can be used and it tastes great. And over time, we continue to outpace our ability to manufacture the protein. So we'd have more sales and we could manufacture and we invested a lot of capital into that facility to increase the capacity. And in about 2018, knew that we had reached really what that facility could do and needed to go to a second manufacturing facility. So we acquired a plant in Western Minnesota, kind of a similar story. It had lived a life as other things. It most recently had been a dairy protein facility and had been shuttered by the company that owned it. We were able to acquire that facility and retrofit it over a period of about 3 years to become a pea protein manufacturing facility. And in 2021, that facility opened. And it is now one of the largest pea protein manufacturing facilities in the world.
How did you find the customers for your pea protein as you were building out these facilities?
I mean, there's a lot of different customers that use pea protein across all categories. And what's been interesting over the last, 3 to 4 years is there's a lot of attention on better for you products, health driven outcomes, food as medicine. These themes have been really prevalent in the media and just in general. And pea protein fits really nicely in that paradigm. So as we're looking at foods that are plant-based or plant-forward or designed for performance and sports nutrition, protein in and of itself is something that people are interested in. And pea protein has the benefit of checking a lot of boxes for consumers. It's non-GMO. It's a complete protein, so it has all the essential amino acids. It's highly functional, meaning you can use it in a lot of different ways. And it just plays a lot of roles. And so we really diversified how our product is used and grown with our customers. So a lot of our customers, when we started, they were also really small. And they've grown and their consumer base has grown. So it's been about building a new market versus trying to capture market share, which is a little bit different. But really exciting because we still feel that the plant-based industry is at the very beginning of what's going to be a very, very long journey to a more sustainable food system.
So you got all these customers, burgers and different products. Cargill, you have a joint venture with. They obviously use a lot of your pea protein, distribute it. But then you decided to be entrepreneurial, as your family is, and start Acre Made and make your own products.
You asked me how we build customers and grow customers in this category. There's a lot of great innovation out there with our customer base in plant-based milks, plant-based meats, and some other categories. But a category that we hadn't seen as much innovation happening was in plant-based eggs. So there's a couple of really strong players out there, but it's a really small category right now, growing rapidly, but we felt it needed more innovation and innovation focusing and using pea protein. And so that was really the why. I also have an egg sensitivity. So I haven't eaten eggs in a long, long time. And so it's also personal to me is having plant-based egg options because there's nothing like easier for a quick meal is eggs. And so we really looked inside our team and say, do we have some innovation that can work on market? And once we found something, we found some partners and we said, let's go. And so we actually launched that product just a couple months ago and are really excited about it. We have a product pipeline of other egg formats. So the egg substitute is a powder that you add water to scramble it. But we'll be coming out with like a baking replacer, egg patties, and other more pre-cooked options to increase the convenience for all types of consumers.
All starting with this seed breeding program that you had so many years ago. It's awesome to hear your story, and it will be even more awesome to see how this thing grows. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back with more Midwest Moxie. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Francis Wang wasn't the most obvious candidate to leave his job for a very small battery materials startup in Chicago. He was a director at China's National Institute of Clean and Low Carbon Energy. The New Jersey native, with his PhD in solid-state chemistry and experience as a scientist at Duracell, Procter & Gamble, and Boston Scientific, had always worked at big organizations. But after a week-long visit to Nanograph, Francis said he was all in. 8 years later, Nanograph has raised about $100 million of funding, including $10 million from the U.S. government, to develop the Midwest's first advanced silicon anode manufacturing facility. Francis, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks, Kathleen. Great to be here, and thanks for having me.
You had a great job in China and a lot of experience at big companies. What happened during that week you went to visit Nanograph that convinced you to change your career trajectory and move to Chicago?
Yeah, probably, it's a good question. It's probably two things. I'd say, you know, number one, I had always had the itch to become an entrepreneur. I was always a little scared of doing so. And just being raised by immigrant parents, I mean, they would always tell you, work for a big company, it's safe and they have good benefits. And, you know, I had always dreamed of it and idolized, you know, people like, you know, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, those types of folks, and always wanted to move the needle. So when it came down, there was, you know, I had that sort of fire in my belly. And the second part of it is, you know, it's a belief I continue to have, but I think successful entrepreneurs or endeavors are really about people. And I think technologies evolve, they change, but it's the people behind the company and the vision that really make a difference. And so I took, I think it was like a week and a half of vacation from my other job. And I said, I'll work here for free. And I want to work with you guys and get to know you. And I was super impressed. I think after a week and a half, I was sold. I knew it was risky. And, you know, I knew it was an uphill battle, but I absolutely believed in the team. And that's, you know, ultimately the mix of always wanting to be an entrepreneur and then finally finding some folks that I thought had everything it took to make a good business and change the world, if you will. And that's what made me take the jump.
You decide to come back after the testing it out. There were three founders, Kerry Hayner, Joshua Lau, and Samir Mayakar, who actually left subsequently to become Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's chief of staff. They had met in a Northwestern University class that brings business and technical students together. This was their baby. So you come walking in and they just hand over the baby?
No, I only wish it was like that. I think they were a smart and are a smart group of people. They understood that, you know, in order to get it to the next level, they could certainly use a little bit more experience, which obviously I brought. They were willing to listen. And, you know, there were things that I was able to bring to the table, you know, having worked in big companies and, you know, there's a lot of processes at big companies that are there for a reason and they're useful and they make companies more efficient. It was that. And then always having someone older in the room, I think can help in terms of team dynamics. Maybe that's a nice way of saying it, but, you know, in the early days, those were kind of contributions that I made to build trust. And I think it's all about trust when something's your baby and it's so important to you and you spent so much of your work career doing that, you don't just hand that over to somebody. So you've got to, you know, it was incumbent on me to create some change quickly and begin to build trust. And we did that. And I think, you know, within a relatively short time became part of the inner circle and you know, the rest is history.
Well, you don't seem like a stomp your feet, pound your fist kind of guy. So maybe it was easier from that perspective, too. But Nanograph has a patented silicon anode material, which has potential to replace the graphite anodes that make lithium. The whole technology makes lithium ion batteries last longer, have higher energy, higher power. One of the important strategies you brought to Nanograph is the idea that you need to develop technology so it can drop in to customers' existing production. Tell us about how that played out as you brought that idea to the company.
Yeah, it's an important concept. And you know, honestly, just I've been in the industry my full career, so like over 25 years. You see a lot of things come and go, right? Things that are successful and those that are not. In our industry, in the battery industry, what is kind of one of those fundamental rules that a lot of companies, believe it or not, startup companies don't follow is this whole idea of drop-in. So, you know, you have, as we do, you know, a company might have some sort of upstream technology, right, that changes the performance of a battery, but you can't expect the world to revolve around you. So you have to create a technology that literally drops in to their existing processes, their existing manufacturing equipment, their existing form factors, et cetera. If you don't do that, and some companies certainly make this mistake of, you know, they have an interesting discovery, but then are asking the industry to make massive amounts of changes, which are, you know, very, very expensive. And these processes have been built up over decades, right? So you're asking companies to make a big change for your technology. That is never a winning combination.
Like,
so
like
one
get,
of the things
get
that,
three new pieces of equipment to integrate the technology, right?
Right. Three new pieces of $100 million equipment, and then we're good to go, right? So that's never a great value proposition when you're selling that to the industry. And so one of the things that we had changed with our technology, which came out of Northwestern University, but it was still a little bit raw, to be honest. And there were parts of it that, you know, quite honestly, were not drop-in. So we did need to morph things, evolve it, pivot a little bit, and create a product that we could send to, you know, somebody like Panasonic, and they could pour it into their machines that made their batteries, and it would work. So that was an important, I would say, evolution of, you know, our problem solution fit, if you will, in the early days, just making sure that our technology was dropping.
So another thing you brought to the company, Nanograph has had a lot of success getting its product to customers by, as you say, going downstream, having customers who believe in your technology put pressure on their supply chain to use your technology in their batteries. Give us an example of how that worked.
Yeah, for sure. So the only way that you survive the gauntlet is to have a champion at the end of the road, right? Way downstream. One of the things we've been able to do is cultivate a great relationship with the U.S. military. U.S. military has a need for new types of batteries. They're willing to pay a little bit more for that. And beyond that, they're interested in supporting U.S. innovation and making sure it gets to market. And so what we've been very successful at doing is building that relationship and having the U.S. government say, hey, Mr. Cellmaker, you need to put this material in your battery. And if you do, I'll buy a lot of them, right? I'm just kind of putting it in simple terms. But that's been very valuable, right? Critical, I'll say, for our company to have a champion like that downstream, like the U.S. military. And I think the same is somewhat true of the Department of Energy on a different scale and for different applications. But I think this is a way that the U.S. government is beginning to exert its influence on the industry and make sure we build up a U.S. battery supply chain in North America.
Well, so tell us about this advanced silicon anode manufacturing facility. You're planning to build it in Chicago, near downtown, near in the West Loop area. It surprised me that you'd think about putting a factory near downtown Chicago.
Yeah. No, I know it might not be, from a number of angles, maybe the most ideal location, but it did make sense for us. To put a little context around this, this is our first step forward, right, in terms of scaling the material. We have been able to get a old warehouse building that will reconvert to make about 50 tons of the material per year. Part of the selection process is a really kind of fundamental one in the sense that, you know, we have a lot of employees that live, you know, in the Chicago metro area. So they also tend to be on the younger side of things. So, you know, having something that is an attractive workplace, is a step up in size from what we had, was all important. So we ended up choosing the West Loop of Chicago as our first step forward into this. Obviously, when we get to the thousand and hundreds of thousands of tons a year, that's certainly going to be, you know, need to be in the boonies.
So listen up, every economic development person who's hearing us. You're making the material to sell to other battery makers in their production, but you're also making your own Nanograph branded batteries. They're a little bit bigger than a double A battery. What do customers use those for?
Yeah, so the military, so the actual battery size is called an 18650. It actually is lithium ion's oldest form factor. If some of your listeners might remember these thick laptops that we used to have, and even your power tools today, those all use 18650 cells. So military uses these from everything from, you know, night vision goggles to radio communications. It is, you know, the most popular form factor that they use. And so it was important for us to be able to control our destiny, if you will. And so we forward integrate it. So we not only make the silicon anode, but have some participation in making the cell that contains our silicon anode.
So in all of this, NanoGraph has potential to help rebuild a U.S. battery supply chain, and particularly in the Midwest. Is that a motivating factor for you?
Oh, 100%. It's the dream these days. You know, this is a Midwest company, right? With Midwest roots and Midwest values. There are so many marquee names in the Midwest. I'll just throw out a few, like Harley-Davidson, John Deere, Caterpillar. These are all companies that are in the process or eventually will be electrifying, right? So you have electric lawnmowers, electric motorbikes, et cetera, et cetera. There's so much need in the Midwest for this. And, you know, we think the center of that universe are helping create jobs and supporting these companies like John Deere and Harley Davidson is having gigafactories and anode factories all within the Midwest. I think that can support an ecosystem that, you know, creates jobs, is part of a, you know, move towards cleaner technologies. And, you know, that's really why we do this.
Well, and it's a really great example of what our universities can do, because this started at Northwestern, the technology, and you gotta develop the technology here to be able to build out the ecosystem here, right?
Absolutely. So we've been blessed and continue to be blessed with the fact that, you know, in Illinois, there's actually, you know, you've got Argonne National Lab, University of Chicago, Northwestern, there's and more universities. There really is a depth of innovation here. And what, you know, this company is trying to do is, you know, make that all important jump from something out of the lab to something at production scale, right? And to be able to produce a product that actually makes to market. It's been a very long time since, you know, a U.S. company has done that in the battery space. So we're super excited about that.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share the NanoGraph story. And we'll look forward to seeing how the company develops.
Thanks, Kathleen.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.